Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, September 11th, 2022. I'll begin with a few local stories, followed by state articles, local sports, and then finally, the horticulture column by Allison Watkins. Venture 19 opens in San Angelo, offering elements of Fredericksburg and new coffee shop, by Rosanna Frere, published September 8th. Venture 19 and Cold Smoke Coffee House have opened in San Angelo in the former Corona's formal wear building, bringing elements of Fredericksburg, according to owner Matt Copeland. The mercantile and coffee shop opened in late July at 1819 Knickerbocker Road and had its ribbon-cutting ceremony on September 7, 2022. Copeland said his team looked at Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, and San Angelo to see where to open their next store and decided that San Angelo had the best market. San Angelo is a great place, Copeland said. The people have been great to meet. Copeland said his team felt they could combine the elements of Fredericksburg and tourism of San Antonio using three of their store concepts, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, Barefoot, and Venture 19. We combined them and brought them to San Angelo so people can feel what Fredericksburg is like without the 2.5-hour commute, Copeland said. Diana Bays, vice president of the Destination Marketing Organization for the Chamber of Commerce, said she expects the store to do well, especially considering the location on Knickerbocker Road, close to San Angelo Stadium. Visitors are constantly looking for Texas items, and we always refer them to the businesses that have the merchandise, Bays said. Venture 19 is open Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., Saturday from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Cold Smoke is open from Monday through Saturday, 6:30 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Abilene ISD confirms bus hits cow on football trip, no injuries, from staff reports. Published September 14th. The Abilene ISD on Wednesday confirmed that a district bus carrying Craig Middle School's 7th graders on a football trip Monday to San Angelo struck a cow on its return to Abilene. The bus driver maintained control of the bus, and there were no injuries to students or other personnel. The bus stayed at scene while another bus came to pick up the passengers. Update: arrest made in San Angelo to threats against San Angelo ISD. By Standard Times staff, published September 12th. Update: an arrest has been made in connection to threats that were made on social media toward San Angelo ISD over the weekend, according to a release from the San Angelo Police Department on Monday morning. A 16-year-old male was taken into custody at a local residence and has been charged with terroristic threats. He was then transported to the Tom Green County Juvenile Justice Center without further incident, according to the release. We would like to thank the public for the numerous phone calls and messages that we received that made us aware of the social media post, the release stated. The goal of the SAPD and the SAISD is to maintain a safe and secure learning environment for all of our students throughout the city of San Angelo. The SAPD and SAISD continue to highly encourage anyone with information regarding possible threats to our schools and students to contact the police department directly with their concerns so we can address them accordingly. Original story. San Angelo ISD alerted the public to a social media threat made Sunday evening with an announcement on the school website early Monday, indicating there will be an increased police presence at the two high school campuses in the district Monday. San Angelo ISD, Central High School, and Lakeview High School were made aware of a threat on social media. Immediately, district leaders and campus administrators began an investigation in conjunction with the San Angelo Police Department. This investigation is currently ongoing, and SAISD will continue to work directly with SAPD to ensure the safety of our students. While school operations continued Monday as normal, the SAISD announcement stated the alleged suspect will not be permitted on or near an SAISD school and both CHS and LVHS will have increased police presence today out of an abundance of caution. The district said it will provide an update to parents at the conclusion of the investigation. The district further stated that the safety of our students is our first priority. We take all matters of this nature seriously and will follow procedures outlined in our student code of conduct. While no suspect was named in the release, the statement indicated it was possibly a student. SAISD, by law, is not at liberty to publicly disclose the names of students or disciplinary actions taken, according to the release. We appreciate the collaborative effort between the school and law enforcement. SAISD encourages everyone to report threats of any kind to a district or school official, local law enforcement, or report the concern on our district Stay Alert link on the SAISD website. Student reports will be kept confidential, the release stated. Alzheimer's Walk in San Angelo to raise awareness and funds for disease, by Rosanna Frere, published September 14th. The Alzheimer's Association is inviting San Angelo students to participate in the 10th annual Walk to End Alzheimer's on Saturday, September 17th. On Walk Day, participants honor those affected by Alzheimer's, a progressive disease that destroys memory and other mental functions. The event will take place at Kirby Park, 1401 Edmond Boulevard. The opening ceremony begins at 9:30 a.m. and the walk starts at 10 a.m. To register and to receive updates on this year's walk, visit alz.org/walk. Join us for this inspiring event for families in our community to honor, celebrate, and remember friends and loved ones affected by a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or other dementia. No one is alone on this journey, and there is hope for a cure, and it will take all of us together to end this disease, said Julie Gray, Director of Development, Alzheimer's Association, West Texas Chapter. The West Texas Chapter hosted a forum on Friday, September 9th at the Baptist Retirement Center, giving information about the disease and local resources. More than 6 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease, and it is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States, according to Janet Cross, Manager of Programs and Services for the West Texas Chapter. Cross and Jessica Kason, Chairman of the Advisory Board, spoke about the disease and the most recent statistics. According to the association, more than 11 million Americans provide the unpaid care to Alzheimer's patients, estimating $321 million in 2022. The numbers are climbing for Alzheimer's, Cross said. We now have the tools to diagnose this with 90 to 95% accuracy, and just a few years ago, we didn't have that. Cross said one in three seniors dies with Alzheimer's or other dementias. In 2020, COVID-19 contributed to a 17% increase in Alzheimer's deaths, according to Kason. The association asked of any gaps or barriers in San Angelo for people needing help with the disease. Attendees said they felt local physicians need to be better educated on the disease and think they feel afraid to diagnose. They also said it's difficult to get in to see a neurologist and pay for treatment. One resource is the Alzheimer's Association's free 24/7 helpline, 800-272-3900. There is also a caregivers support group every fourth Thursday of the month from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Henley Maybe Activity Room at 903 North Main Street. Attendees can develop a support system, talk through issues and ways of coping, learn about community resources, and more. Another resource the association offers is Trial Match, a service to help find clinical trials for Alzheimer's and other dementias. If you have questions about Trial Match or your clinical study matches, call the Alzheimer's Association at 800-272-3900 or email trialmatch@alz.org. Smoothie King opens its doors in San Angelo, by Rosanna Frere, published September 8th. Smoothie King has opened its doors in San Angelo, joining other businesses in the former Corona's formal wear building. The Smoothie King bar opened in mid-August at 1819 Knickerbocker Road, along with Jason's Deli, Cold Smoke, and Venture 19. We're committed to blending a more nutritious smoothie with whole fruits and organic veggies and removing artificial ingredients and added sugars in many blends, according to the business's Facebook page. Our unique menu options are purposely blended to meet your specific needs, goals, and ambitions. The business has a drive-through and a mobile app for customers to order ahead and earn rewards. Smoothie King is open 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday, and 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday. And now state news. Recent partisan defections show that in politics, lame ducks can fly freely. Free from having to run again in their own primaries, three Texas politicians can express their feelings without fearing repercussions at the polls. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published September 10th in the San Angelo Standard Times, Austin. Question: where do political dinosaurs go to die? Answer: across party lines. Sure, the riddle is snarky and a bit oversimplified, but a few recent examples do offer a shade of truth to it. In the past week, two retiring GOP office holders let it be known that they've had it up to their chins with Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and have endorsed his Democratic opponent, Mike Collier. Patrick's top advisor called them dinosaurs because their decades-long political careers are coming to an end. A day or so later, a retiring Democratic state senator endorsed Patrick, calling him a legend who deserves a third term. Interestingly, the Democrat, Brownsville's Eddie Lucio Jr., entered politics in the 1980s, well before either of the maverick Republicans, Amarillo State Senator Kel Seliger and Tarrant County Judge Glenn Whitley. But Patrick's camp steered clear of the dinosaur label for the retiring Democrat. Two Republican problems with Dan Patrick. Seliger, a senator since 2001, and before that the mayor of his hometown, and Whitley, who has held his office for 12 years, did not join Collier's camp because they had suddenly shifted their political center of gravity to the left. Both can be described as pragmatic conservatives, which means they understand that government is obliged to provide basic services and that those services cost money. Not necessarily an extravagant amount of money, but still money. At least part of the problem with Patrick is the lieutenant governor's longtime devotion to cutting property taxes, a policy that makes a great bumper sticker for any Republican, but it's more complicated. The state doesn't levy property taxes. In fact, it's constitutionally forbidden from doing so. So any property tax reduction mandated by the legislature is actually a measure limiting how much cities, counties, hospital districts, school boards, and such can take from local property owners. As Whitley noted when he told reporters that he'd buck his party in the lieutenant governor's race, leaders elected at the local level can't punt their responsibilities to provide uncompensated care at public hospitals or jail space to local lawbreakers, even if state officials seek to tie their hands financially. Seliger got crossways with the lieutenant governor, who presides over the Texas Senate and sets its agenda, when he was one of the few elected Republicans who in 2017 opposed the so-called bathroom bill, which would have limited public restroom options for transgender people. He also opposed Patrick's embrace of school vouchers. In 2019, Seliger was stripped of his chairmanship of the Senate Higher Education Committee. And in 2021, his Senate district was carved up and probably made unwinnable. Rather than, in his words, kowtow to Patrick, Seliger opted to retire. Why Eddie Lucio Jr. likes Dan Patrick. Lucio's situation was different. He has long been the Senate's most conservative Democrat. He was the only one in his party to support Patrick's bathroom bill, and he is as opposed to abortion as any Republican in Texas politics. For decades, being a squishy Democrat cost him nothing in his heavily Catholic South Texas district. But in 2020, a younger and more progressive challenger gave him a scare in the primary, forcing him into a runoff that he won by only 8 percentage points. Had he opted to run this cycle, he might have lost the primary. Even though Patrick's opponent in 2018 was the same Collier he's facing in the upcoming November 8th election, the two Republicans who oppose him did not, at least publicly, do so 4 years ago. After all, they were running in their Republican primaries. Lucio, for his part, did not stick his own neck out for Patrick in 2018. He was not up for re-election then, but knew he would have to face Democratic primary voters in 2020. And the primaries are where the real action is in Texas politics, especially in legislative districts where gerrymandering plays a giant role. That means there's no real percentage in picking an intramural fight, be it Democrat on Democrat or Republican on Republican, as long as your own skin is in the game. But once politicians announce they are not running, they become lame ducks. And in politics, sometimes only the lame ducks have the ability to fly freely. John C. Moritz covers Texas government and politics for the USA Today Network in Austin. Texas Oil Lobby says EPA air quality plan could stifle production in the Permian Basin. The Environmental Protection Agency has stepped up monitoring in the nation's most productive oil field to see if greenhouse gas emissions need to be curtailed. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Times, published September 14th in the San Angelo Standard Times. Austin. Texas's largest oil lobby is mounting a grassroots effort designed to pressure the Environmental Protection Agency from implementing new air pollution regulations in the Texas-New Mexico Permian Basin, where 40% of the nation's traditional energy sources are mined. The Texas Oil and Gas Association, or TXOGA, on Tuesday distributed an electronic pamphlet titled Keep Drilling in the Basin, warning of a proposal that would require the state to develop a federally approved plan for meeting air quality standards in portions of the nation's most productive region for oil and gas production. The pamphlet urges Texans to contact the EPA to raise objections to the planned action in the Permian Basin. TXOGA, founded in 1919 when Texas was gaining national dominance in oil and gas production, said operators in the Permian are already focused on lowering emissions in the basin that the U.S. Energy Information Administration on Monday said is expected to set a record in October by producing more than 5.4 million barrels of crude per day. The EPA should recognize this and stop interfering with our energy security by developing crippling and unnecessary regulations on Permian oil and natural gas production, TXOGA said in the publication. In August, the EPA announced it was conducting helicopter flyovers over the Permian in both Texas and New Mexico so infrared cameras could survey drilling operations for emissions of methane and volatile organic compounds. The flyovers came after the EPA's announcement in the spring that it is considering imposing the new air quality steps for Texas. By using helicopter surveillance, EPA can assess a large geographic area and survey operations from thousands of oil and gas operations in the basin, the federal agency said. When the infrared camera detects hydrocarbon emissions during a flyover, a technician on board the helicopter will note the time, GPS location, and other information about the emissions source. The EPA said it will use data it collects to identify the facility that released the excess greenhouse emissions and then initiate enforcement actions. The oil and gas lobby group is piggybacking on a letter Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent to President Joe Biden late last month, warning that new regulations would jeopardize 25% of our nation's gasoline supply. Abbott also contended the EPA was using flawed data and that some of the pollutants picked up by the flyovers likely originated in Mexico and wafted north to the Permian Basin. Of course, the dearth of logic and data to support the administration's position has little to do with process and procedure, Abbott said in his letter. It is grounded in your desire to eliminate oil and gas production in Texas. As you said during your campaign, I guarantee you we're going to end fossil fuels. According to a report published Tuesday in the industry trade journal, Crude Oil Prices Today, the Permian Basin is powering a national energy boom that has picked up steam since the COVID-19 pandemic began to recede. National production has reached 11.8 million barrels per day, the highest since April 2020, the report said. That's still below the record high rate of production U.S. drillers had reached right before the pandemic struck, but a significant recovery from the pandemic collapse in production, the publication said. The 2022 Texas Governor's Race Debate. Here's what you need to know. The September 30th debate will take place on a Friday night in South Texas and will likely be the only time Greg Abbott and Beto O'Rourke will go one-on-one before the November 8th election. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published September 9th in the San Angelo Standard Times, Austin. Incumbent Republican Governor Greg Abbott and Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke have agreed to a single debate ahead of the November 8th election, and it will take place in Edinburgh on Friday, September 30th. Here are some of the things to know about the matchup. The debate venue is in South Texas. O'Rourke and Abbott will share the stage at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley in Edinburgh for 1 hour. The start time is 7 p.m. Central Time. Why is the debate in South Texas? The official reason is because that's where both campaigns and the Nexstar Media Group, the debate sponsor, have agreed to meet. An unofficial reason might be that South Texas, once a pretty solid lock for Democrats, is now considered up for grabs, and the Abbott camp says it's putting up the resources to make it competitive. O'Rourke, meanwhile, is neither taking the region for granted nor writing it off. The final leg of his recently completed 49-day drive across Texas started out in communities along the Rio Grande. Where you can watch the Texas Governor's Race Debate. Nexstar is a national media organization that has a presence in 14 Texas markets that will air the debate live. They are Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, Waco-Temple Bryan, Rio Grande Valley, El Paso, Tyler-Longview, Amarillo, Midland-Odessa, Lubbock, Wichita Falls, Abilene, and San Angelo. The organization has also reached an agreement with the San Antonio television station to air the debate and says it's in talks with stations in other markets, including Corpus Christi, to extend the debate's reach as far as possible. Stay tuned for any updates. Why is there only one Abbott-O'Rourke debate? The Abbott camp has made clear that the governor is only interested in a single one-on-one meeting as he seeks a third four-year term. There was only one debate in each of his first two runs for the office. O'Rourke, who has participated in dozens of town hall-style campaign events this year, wanted four events that included questions from the audience that he and the governor would address. Several media organizations said they'd be happy to sponsor the events, but the governor's office said no thanks. Can a governor's race debate make a difference on election day? It's tough to say with certainty, but it will provide voters their only chance to see both candidates on the same stage taking questions from Texas journalists. And it will be the only chance for the candidates, who have lobbed criticisms at one another from afar for the better part of a year, to challenge each other face to face. What are O'Rourke's and Abbott's qualifications to be Texas governor? Abbott, 64, grew up in the Dallas area and practiced law in Houston before entering politics. His first elective office was a state district judgeship in Harris County. He served on the Texas Supreme Court for 5 years in three terms, totaling 12 years, as the state attorney general before being elected governor in 2014. He was reelected in 2018. He won by comfortable margins in both races. O'Rourke, 49, grew up in El Paso and later co-founded Stanton Street Technology Group. He began his political career as a city council member in his hometown. He served for 6 years, including 1 year as mayor pro tem. From there, he served three terms in Congress before relinquishing what was considered a safe Democratic seat to challenge Republican U.S. Senator Ted Cruz in 2018. He lost by 2.6 percentage points and used that as a springboard for a short-lived quest for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. Are Abbott and O'Rourke the only candidates in the 2022 Texas governor's race? No, there are five others whose names will be on the November 8th ballot. They are Mark Tippetts, a Libertarian, Delilah Barrios of the Green Party, and Jacqueline Abernathy and Mark V. Golby, who qualified as write-in candidates. Why are the others not participating in the debate? Under NextStar's rules, a candidate must receive at least 10% support in an established, professionally conducted nonpartisan poll and have raised at least $50,000 in campaign contributions to qualify for a place on the stage in Edinburgh. None of the non-major party candidates have cleared those hurdles. From the front page of the San Angelo Standard-Times, Tuesday, September 13th. State pursues trans child inquiries. Families say investigations expanding, by Chuck Lindell, Austin American Statesman. State child abuse investigators are still pursuing families with transgender children and, in at least one case, expanded the investigation beyond Governor Greg Abbott's ordered scrutiny of gender-affirming medical care, a new court filing says. The filing included affidavits from two mothers who, using pseudonyms to protect their families from harassment, described the devastating effect the child abuse investigations have had on their children. One, 13-year-old Steve, was pulled out of class August 30th and questioned by a state child abuse investigator, leading to anxiety attacks and missed classes, disrupting his education, and upending hard-won improvements to his mental health, Mother Carol Coe wrote. This is extremely upsetting given he has been doing so well in school this year, both socially and in his classes, she wrote. The other, 14-year-old Whitley, has never received gender-affirming medical care, but the Department of Family and Protective Services has declined to close its investigation after more than 6 months and instead added a new requirement, telling Mother Samantha Poe on August 25th that investigators wanted proof that Whitley is well-adjusted. These requests come 6 months after confirmation my child is not receiving medical care and independent confirmation by one of Whitley's teachers that they were doing well, Poe wrote. The Coe and Poe affidavits were provided last week to State District Judge Amy Clark Meacham, who has already issued two injunctions barring child abuse investigations of several families with transgender adolescents and is weighing a request to protect additional families from the investigations. State Attorney General Ken Paxton has asked an appeals court to overturn Meacham's injunctions, arguing in part that the families don't have standing to sue because they complained of potential, not actual harm. No transgender children have been removed from home and placed into foster care, and no parents have been placed on the state's child abuse registry, his lawyers have argued. The mother's affidavits directly challenged those arguments, telling Meacham that their children and families have been traumatized by the investigations. Disruptive and dramatic. Carol Coe and her son, an eighth grader in an undisclosed part of Texas, was suffering from depression and had attempted suicide. He shared with me that it was so difficult to consider coming out as transgender that taking his own life seemed like the only option, she wrote. Two therapists diagnosed Steve with gender dysphoria, and his endocrinologist and pediatrician recommended medical treatment that included puberty blockers and hormones. The change in Steve was remarkable, Coe said. After facing so much depression and distress, he is finally himself again. During that difficult time, Steve had to be homeschooled, but he was finally able to return to public school, Coe wrote. I have seen him make friends and laugh again. He is finally comfortable with himself and happy. That changed 2 weeks ago when a state child abuse investigator unexpectedly arrived at Steve's school in the morning and, referring to him by the name and sex assigned at birth, had Steve brought into a conference room. For nearly an hour, she asked my son personal questions about himself, his most intimate thoughts, his family, his diagnosis, his medical history, and current health care, all the while keeping him separated from his classmates and keeping him out of class. At one point, she asked him if he was taking any performance-enhancing drugs, Coe wrote. Told the investigator's next step was to interview his parents, Steve was so upset that he could not go back to class, she said. Steve told me he had a meltdown and became very fearful and upset that something might happen to me or his dad because of who he is, Coe wrote, adding that Steve has been unable to fully return to class, leaving early with panic attacks and anxiety. The trauma this investigation has added to my son's life is unwarranted and unnecessary, Coe told the judge. This intrusion into our lives, our privacy, and my right as a parent to direct my child's upbringing has been disruptive and traumatic, and I don't want other Texas families to go through a traumatic experience like ours. Exhausted and frustrated. Legal fights began shortly after Paxton issued a non-binding attorney general's opinion in February that said gender-affirming care violated state laws against child abuse. Medical experts said Paxton's opinion relied on false claims, exaggerations, and errors. But Abbott quickly signed on, directing the Department of Family and Protective Services to investigate all reports of gender-affirming care as potential child abuse. Within a week of Abbott's February 22nd directive, a child abuse investigator contacted Poe about Whitley, who was assigned the sex of male at birth and is exploring what a social transition feels like, Poe told Meacham. Social transitioning can involve changing names, clothing, and appearance to conform with gender identity, and Poe said Whitley had been doing very well before Paxton's opinion and Abbott's directive. Poe said she quickly provided investigators with a letter from Whitley's psychiatrist confirming that her child, who uses the pronouns they and them, had not received any medical care related to their gender identity. Poe also declined to tell Whitley about the matter. I assumed that the investigation would be closed quickly, and I could protect my child from additional stress and worry about what might happen to me and whether they would be removed from my care, she told the judge. Significantly, therapists working with my child warned me that having contact with DFPS and learning I was being investigated may destabilize and cause harm to Whitley. Instead of closing the case, a Child Protective Services investigator asked in May to schedule a viewing of Whitley, but Poe said she refused. When her lawyer asked the agency to close its investigation in August, the department scheduled an August 25th phone call with an agency lawyer who asked to schedule an interview with Whitley or have some third party confirmed they are well-adjusted, Poe wrote. Again, she declined, pointing out that Whitley had not received gender-affirming medical care. Poe recently decided to tell Whitley about the investigation, saying she feared that CPS would pull her child out of class or word would leak out if the agency contacted the principal or teachers. Whitley seemed to take the news well, but 2 weeks later, a school counselor sent them home, saying the investigation led the student to express suicidal ideation, Poe wrote. I am very exhausted and frustrated at this point, she said, noting that instead of ending the investigation, upon learning that Whitley was not receiving the type of care that Paxton and Abbott had objected to, the agency added requirements, including proof of the child's well-being. This investigation has been so drawn out that I feel like it is never going to go away until either I give up my civil liberties or the state comes and takes them and my child, Poe added. What comes next? Meacham has sided with families of transgender adolescents twice. In March, the judge ordered the Department of Family and Protective Services to cease all child abuse investigations that were based solely on the provision of gender-affirming care, ruling that children were being placed at risk and parental rights were being violated. After Paxton appealed, the Texas Supreme Court blocked Meacham's injunction from applying statewide, but left the ban on investigations in place for the one family that had sued. Freed from Meacham's statewide injunction, state child welfare workers resumed investigating families of transgender adolescents in May, prompting a second lawsuit by three targeted families and PFLAG, a leading LGBTQ advocacy organization. A second injunction from Meacham in July blocked investigations of two of the families. The third had already been cleared of abuse allegations. In her order, Meacham said she was still weighing whether to extend the injunction's protection to members of PFLAG. The judge also invited the parties to file additional evidence that could help her make that decision, leading to the affidavits from Coe and Poe, both of whom are members of PFLAG. In the meantime, Paxton's bid to overturn both injunctions remains before the Austin-based Third Court of Appeals, which is one step below the Texas Supreme Court, where the issue is expected to be decided. And now sports. Angelo State. Number 7, Angelo State shakes number 9, Colorado School of Mines in Overtime Thriller by Charles Bryce, published September 11th. Asa Fuller booted a 36-yard field goal in overtime, leading number 7, Angelo State University, to a 30-27 nail-biter against number 9, Colorado School of Mines in a non-conference football game in Golden, Colorado on Saturday afternoon. ASU, 2-0, avenged a loss against CSM, 0-2, in the NCAA Division II quarterfinals last year in Colorado. The Rams won the OT coin flip, and they decided to go on defense first. After keeping CSM from putting any more points on the scoreboard, the Rams took over, and Fuller came through in the clutch with the game-winning kick. The Ore Diggers were 8-0 at home in 2021. The contest was tied at 10-10 in the half, and Mines took a 24-17 lead into the fourth quarter. The Rams outscored the Ore Diggers 10-3 in the fourth to push it to overtime. "It was a good game," ASU head coach Jeff Gersh said. "That's a really good football team that we played. Something tells me we'll be playing them again at some point in the playoffs as long as we take care of business. I'm proud of our guys." "We knew we were a good football team coming into the game. The kids believed, even when we got down. We took the lead in the third quarter. We went right down the field and scored and gave it back up and had a pick six. We just did some things that weren't what we've been doing, and our guys didn't waver." Gersh tipped his hat to his kicker, who had 3 field goals on the day. "I'm so proud of Asa Fuller," the Rams coach said. "He missed another field goal to start the game, and he had missed 2 the week before. He's a stud, and I wasn't going to waver on him at all with things. He stepped in there and kicked 3 really big field goals for us. I just couldn't be more proud of him, doing what he's doing and fighting the storm a little bit." Rams senior quarterback Zach Bronckhorst proved once again that he's a dual-threat QB who keeps defenses on their toes. "His off-season training and what he did this summer to get himself into better shape has made a big difference in 2022, Gersh said. "He was already in good shape, but he's in even better shape. Moving around the pocket and doing some things, he really extended plays for us and gave us opportunities to look downfield and throw the ball down there. We had a couple of completions like that that kept us right in this ball game and gave us a chance to win at the end. I'm very proud of him. One of the 2 interceptions that he threw, quite frankly, wasn't his fault. We got pulled down at receiver and he was throwing to a spot and the receiver didn't get there. One of the interceptions was on him. He's got to make big decisions with that ball, but he does an awesome job and I'm very proud of Zach." Bronckhorst was 17 of 34 for 173 yards and 2 interceptions. Rams running back Alfred Greer had a 60-yard touchdown run in the second quarter before getting banged up a little and taking the second half off to be safe. "He went down right before halftime," Gersh said. "He had a really couple of big runs for us. We kept him out of the second half, and we'll see how that goes. I don't have much information on his injury yet." Greer had 5 carries on 81 yards and 1 TD. Senior running back Nate Omagbu was sidelined with an injury in last year's playoff loss against the Ore Diggers, but he was able to play Saturday, which gave the Rams' running game a big lift. "Nate's a fierce competitor," the ASU coach said of the top rusher in the Lone Star Conference last season. "He's a guy who can take the ball to the end zone from 60 yards away, and he's a guy who can get you that tough yard. He's an outstanding football player, and yeah, that definitely makes a difference when you've got a guy like Nate and the caliber of football player that he is on your team." Omayabu finished with 21 carries for 89 yards and a 37-yard TD in the fourth quarter. He also caught 3 passes for 37 yards. Receiving-wise, Kyle Bradford led the Rams with 3 receptions for 52 yards. Noah Massey had 4 for 43. The Rams' defense played an instrumental role in the overtime thriller. "Their quarterback, John Matocha, is as good a football player as there is in Division II in my eyes, with how he runs their offense and kind of makes them go offensively, as well as Michael Zeman, the running back," Gersh said. "They're 2 All-American candidates." We had to go out and shut people down, and we were banged up on defense coming into this week. We had some guys who didn't play today on defense, but it's the next guy up mentality over there. Our guys stepped up and did a great job, not shutting down, but really limiting a great offense. I'm really proud of those guys and their effort today. Micah Flowers had a team-high 10 tackles for ASU and one sack. Tre'Darius Colbert had 8 tackles and 1.5 sacks, and Jordan McKinney had 7 tackles. ASU's other TD came on a 46-yard run by Kaysen Phillips in the third quarter. The Rams will open up LSC play against UT Permian Basin at 6 p.m. Saturday, September 17th in Odessa. After this week's performance, the Rams will be taking a lot of momentum into the LSC opener. It's great to be 2-0 going into conference, Gersh said. That's always something that you strive for. And again, playing against two really good football teams, Mines and Chadron State, they were picked, I think, 1-3 in their conference. Getting two wins like that, that's going to breed confidence for our guys moving into Lone Star Conference play. The biggest thing I think of is these guys get to go back on Monday and start getting coached again by his staff. This staff did an unbelievable job today in preparation. They had preparation all week, but the actual work today on the field of calling plays and designing plays, this staff has gotten our players ready to go each and every day. I couldn't be more proud of our staff. I'm blessed with the guys we have here. San Angelo Central falls to Abilene Cooper in overtime, by Paul Harris, published September 9th. San Angelo Central overcame a 15-point deficit in the final 5 minutes of regulation, but the Bobcats came up short in overtime in a 41-38 loss to Abilene Cooper on Friday at Shotwell Stadium in Abilene. After Chase Miller connected on a 24-yard field goal in OT to give Central a 38-35 lead, Cooper responded with a 22-yard touchdown pass on 3rd-and-7 from Chris Warren to Malik Jackson to end the game. Cooper held a 35-20 lead for much of the second half before Central began its comeback attempt on a touchdown pass from Tyler Hill to Jacob English with 4:55 left in the fourth quarter. The Bobcats picked up the 2-point conversion to get within 35-28. Central then blocked a punt, and Austin Johnson returned it for a score with 1:40 remaining. Miller, who was 3 of 3 on FGs, knocked through the extra point to send the game into overtime. It was the second TD of the game for Johnson, who returned an interception for a score to give the Bobcats a 10-0 lead less than 3 minutes into the game. Cooper got on the scoreboard when a failed field goal try led to the holder, Warren, running the ball for a TD. The game was filled with big plays, and the wildest one might have been Cooper's Daniel Bray breaking a 66-yard TD run on the final play of the first half for a 28-20 lead. The Bobcats had just scored with 26 seconds left in the second quarter to get within 21-20. The two former district rivals will now each have a record of 1-2. Central will host Belton next week, while Cooper will visit Lubbock Coronado. Lakeview suffers first loss of season against Vernon, by Amy McDaniel, published September 10th. The Vernon Lions handed San Angelo Lakeview its first defeat of the 2022 season, beating the Chiefs 23-12 in a Class 4A non-district football game Friday at San Angelo Stadium. It was a battle of undefeated teams, but it was the Lions who stayed perfect and spoiled Lakeview's homecoming game with a deliberate offensive attack that kept the ball out of the Chiefs' hands for most of the first and fourth quarters. Those types of offenses, that's what they're meant to do, chew up the clock, said Lakeview head coach Hector Guevara. We had a chance to get them off the field earlier and were able to do it later, but those offenses are definitely hard to replicate in practice. That's what they do all day. They work on mesh and mesh points, just like we work on throwing. Vernon improved to 3-0 for the season, while Lakeview, 2-1, was attempting to go 3-0 to start the season for the first time since 2019. Lakeview hopes to bounce back on a short week as they travel to Lubbock High on Thursday, September 15th. The Lions led at halftime 16-6. Lakeview finally got on the scoreboard late in the third quarter on a 36-yard TD pass from Isaiah Salazar to Derek Taylor. Taylor, tightly covered, read the ball and slowed up along the Chiefs sideline about 4 yards from the goal line to make the catch and then easily walked in the TD to pull Lakeview within 16-6 with 2:46 to play in the third quarter. But Vernon held the ball from the 2:46 point of the third quarter to the 7:50 point of the fourth before the Chiefs were able to turn the ball over on downs. Defensively, they gave us opportunities early in the game, Guevara said the Derek Alambar-coached Chief defense. Offensively, we adjusted at halftime, but we just ran out of time. The Chiefs, however, could go nowhere, being forced to risk a fourth down play on their own end of the field just to try to climb back in it. Vernon stopped the Chiefs and took over at the Lakeview 34 and gave the Chiefs a steady diet of runs by T.J. Thomas, and the Lions scored on an 8-yard run by Jevon Fanner with 3:24 to play to take a 23-6 lead. Lakeview added a TD with 56 to play on a 12-yard pass from Salazar to Devastian Manley and recovered the onside kick, but threw an interception with 49 to play as the Lions secured the win. Taylor said it was frustrating as the game clock ticked away the Chiefs' offensive chances in the fourth quarter. The only way I could think of to get the ball back was if they threw it, said Taylor, who plays on both sides of the ball. We'll just practice harder and go and win the next one. Chiefs defensive lineman Juan Ortiz said, it's not a matter of having to scrap everything and go back to the drawing board for the Lakeview defense. What they were doing really well was executing plays more often, Ortiz said. We've got to get better as a team and get the next game. In addition to having one less day to prepare for Lubbock High, the Westerners are the lone Class 5A team on the Chiefs' schedule. Lubbock was typically a district opponent for the Chiefs before they moved down to 4A, and it's the first time the two teams have met since 2017. Guevara said he was happy with the Chiefs' effort against Vernon, but the execution needs to improve. They never quit, and we had opportunities to get in the game, but we shot ourselves in the foot offensively, Guevara said. We've got to go make plays. In a win over Sweetwater last week, the Chiefs piled up 331 rushing yards and scored 4 rushing TDs. Against Vernon, the Chiefs were held to 93 rushing yards and no TDs. Ortiz said the Chiefs need to focus on preparing for the next opponent. We've got to keep practicing, be more prepared, the senior said. Just keep going at it. Work harder, tougher. UIL suspends Richland Springs coach Burkhart for 3 seasons, by Amy McDaniel, published September 12th. The UIL State Executive Committee found that a recruiting violation occurred and issued a public reprimand and a 3-year coaching suspension for Richland Springs High School's Jerry Burkhart, a 9-time state championship football coach. Richland Springs High School was also found to have violated Section 409 of the UIL Constitution and contest rules, and the SEC issued a public reprimand and a 3-year probation, stopping short of a playoff ban for the Class 1A Division II football program. There was no finding of guilt for Richland Springs assistant coach Sean Rogers, who was also before the committee, meeting in Pflugerville in an appeal of the August 23rd, 16 1A Division II District Executive DEC committee finding. The SEC also denied the appeal of a Richland Springs student athlete who was found by the DEC to have violated Section 443 of the CNCR, moving for athletic purposes. The SEC, however, did not extend the ineligibility period for the student athlete beyond one school year. The athlete may participate in junior varsity competition only until the 2023-24 school year. According to the UIL website, the SEC is made up of school administrators from across the state. Smaller panels are formed in order to hear appeals of DEC decisions. On Monday, committee members present included Mike Motherall, the chairman, along with Vice Chair Joanna Denson and Paul Galvin. Also present were UIL staff members Dr. Charles Brightup, the executive director of the UIL, along with Jamie Harrison, UIL deputy director, although only the committee members are allowed to vote on the appeal. The main focus of the discussion leading up to the unanimous 4-0 vote by the SEC that upheld the DEC decision was the 14-minute-long phone conversation between Burkhart and the student-athlete prior to his enrollment at Richland Springs High School. Great programs recruit themselves. People go there because of the success, Breithart said in addressing Burkhart. You don't have to do that recruiting. You stayed on a phone conversation that length of time. That just doesn't smell right. I think the DEC did a thorough job. The information was compelling enough to accuse you of recruiting, the UIL's top official continued. Those 14 minutes, I just can't help but to believe that you didn't know better than to stay on a call with an athlete from another school, and then to not reach out to Mullen and let them know that conversation took place, and let your superintendent know. That's problematic. I don't know about all this other documentation, but that alone puts you in a bad light, Breithaupt said. Motherall, the superintendent of schools at Sundown ISD, said, Big mistake here. Big mistake. I can't begin to get past the 14 minutes. It creates in me no doubt about what was going on. That's my opinion. That young man reached out to you. That ought to be a 30-second call. You were on for 14 minutes. So for me, this is a recruiting issue. That's my personal opinion, based on facts and evidence, the committee chairman said. A text message conversation between the coach and Mullen, where the student athlete had been in attendance through his sophomore year and earned all-state honors in football, and Burkhart on August 4th, was mentioned multiple times in the sworn testimony on Monday. Galvin, the superintendent at Fort Worth ISD, wanted to know why Burkhart didn't immediately reach out to Mullen football coach Brent Williamson when he received the phone call from the student athlete on August 8th, 4 days after the text message from Williamson to Burkhart alerting him to a potential violation, and 4 days prior to when the student athlete enrolled at Richland Springs. I go back to the previous conversation with the Mullen coach and Coach Burkhart 4 days before the telephone call, which came out about the recruiting situation, Galvin said. You should have been better prepared to say you're not talking about this and for them to contact the administration, period. That ends the conversation. When that did happen, the coach from Mullen was never contacted that you had gotten the call. To me, it's a recruiting issue, and this should have never happened. The appeal for the recruiting violation was the second item on the meeting agenda and the first opportunity for the Richland Springs representatives to speak. Burkhart presented evidence that showed the same 14-minute-long conversation by phone with the student-athlete. You're going to have to try to explain that, Motherall said. Burkhart replied, yes. On August 4th, I received a text message from Mullen coach Brent Williamson, Burkhart began, that Coach Rogers and I had been talking to some kids of his. I replied, Coach, I don't know what you're talking about. As I was down in Utopia, Texas, working on real estate, I received a phone call from Goldthwaite. I didn't know the number. I answered. He said, Coach Burkhart, I want to talk to you about moving to Richland Springs. My first thought is, I know his dad's on the board at Mullen ISD. I thought I was being set up. My question, just like you, I was asking, why do you want to move to Richland Springs? Burkhart stated. Motherall interrupted and said, no, it's not what my first question would be. My first question would be, it wouldn't be a question. It would be, I can't talk to you about it. If you want to go to school here, you need to go talk to somebody else. Yes, sir. My mind running through my mind was I wanted to be as professional as I could and say, you can't move for athletic purposes. I listened to the student athlete who said all those things like he said here today, about 11 or 12 minutes. At the end of the conversation, I said, son, you can't move for athletic purposes. I said, your parents do not live in the district. Your dad is on the school board. Your parents need to come to the school. And I ended the conversation. But the majority of the story was him telling me about his girlfriend at Richland Springs and how his mom didn't want him to come, how his dad kinda did. The young man talked to me during that time, and I felt like if I didn't say what I needed to, that it was a he said, she said conversation. And you're right. What difference does it make that his dad was on the school board? Motherall stated. You keep bringing that up. I would never recruit a kid anyway, but much less a kid whose father is on the school board, Burkhart replied. Motherall asked, so there is a difference for you? I'm saying I wouldn't do it. It's a ridiculous accusation, Burkhart replied. Motherall asked, you make the determination whether somebody is notable in the district as to whether or not you're going to recruit them? No, sir, I'm not a recruiter, Burkhart said. I felt like I was being set up, sir. Richland Springs, ranked number 2 in the state, has a 3-0 record in 2022 and has an open date this Friday. The Coyotes return to action on September 23rd. The Standard Times was unable to determine at press time who will coach Richland Springs for the remainder of the season. And now here's the column from Allison Watkins. Fall brings new hope for gardeners after rough summer. Published September 8th. Summer was quite rough and discouraging for home gardeners, but the autumn season is always a refreshing encouragement to try again. Fall is a wonderful time of year to grow food. It gets easier and more productive as temperatures go down and rain returns. If you'd like to start over with some warm season crops like tomatoes, purchase large transplants, gallon containers or larger, and get them planted right away to have a plentiful harvest before freezing temperatures arrive later in the year. Or plant in containers that can be brought inside to extend the growing season past the first fall freeze when it comes around. After it cools down a bit more, around late September or early October, it's a good time to start planting winter vegetables. Cool season crops are cold hardy and can withstand freezing temperatures once established. These winter season vegetables include artichoke, beet, bok choy, broccoli, Brussels sprout, cabbage, carrot, cauliflower, chard, collard greens, garlic, kale, kohlrabi, leek, lettuce, mustard, bunching onion, radish, shallot, spinach, and turnip. Many of these plants can be purchased from local nurseries or can be direct seeded into the garden bed. Incorporate compost into the soil before planting and finish off with a thick layer of wood mulch to help reduce transplant shock, conserve water, and prevent weeds. If planting seeds, wait for the plants to emerge before applying the mulch. If growing in containers, use potting mix instead of real soil and make sure the container has good drainage. Standing water will damage roots and cause the plant to decline and can attract pests such as fungus gnats. Drip irrigation is the best way to irrigate vegetables since it applies the water directly to the soil for the roots to absorb instead of being splashed on the leaves. It can be pretty simple to do it yourself with a little practice. For tips, visit tomgreen.agrilife.org/horticulture and click on low volume irrigation. Join the Concho Valley Master Gardeners on Saturday, September 24th for a workshop on fall vegetable gardening in containers, or stop by after the workshop to purchase some cool season vegetables such as Swiss chard, lettuce, and spinach. The workshop, 9 to 10 a.m., requires pre-registration. Visit tomgreen.agrilife.org or call 325-659-6522 and will include a hands-on planting project that you take home with you. Or just stop by from 10 a.m. to noon or until sold out to purchase leafy green vegetables and herbs grown by the Master Gardeners. Location, Tom Green 4-H Center, 3168 North U.S. Highway 67. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.